Good morning. I'm Leslie Thatcher. 8:06 on this Tuesday, February 7th, 16 degrees here in Old Town Park City and blue sky. On the phone with us from the ABC Forecast Center, meteorologist Thomas Keyboy. Good morning.
Morning, Leslie. Happy Tuesday. So we had a messy Monday morning commute, and today is going to be a little bit more tranquil for this Tuesday. High pressure briefly settling in, so across the Wasatch Back, we'll mainly see mostly sunny to partly cloudy skies for today. It's going to be a beautiful day if you want to head up into the mountains, where around 8,000 feet, the temperatures will be close to freezing. But if you're heading up to Park City, we'll also be looking at a daytime high right around freezing. We'll see a daytime high of around 33. And then as we move forward going into tonight, clouds will gradually begin to increase because as quickly as the high pressure moves in, it'll start to move away to our southeast. So by tonight, partly cloudy to mostly cloudy skies, an overnight low dropping to 17 degrees. And then for our Wednesday, most likely going to start off with sunshine, but there is a weak disturbance that's going to be coming in from the northwest. It looks like the bulk of the moisture is going to be to our east, but there will still be about a 40% chance that we could see some isolated to scattered snow showers, mainly during the second half of the day. And if we do see some accumulations, not expecting anything to be too significant, maybe a couple of inches for the mountains and maybe some minor accumulations down in Park City. The daytime high will top out right around 32 degrees. So again, we'll see partly cloudy skies, but maybe a little bit more cloud coverage if we actually see the moisture play out. Then as we go into Wednesday night, we get partly cloudy skies, the overnight low dropping to 8 degrees. So with the system moving through, even though it's not going to have a ton of moisture with it, it will at least bring some colder temperatures for our Wednesday night and some breezy conditions to go on top of that, which means the wind chill on Wednesday night could be a little frigid as we start Wednesday night into Thursday morning. And Thursday and Friday, high pressure builds back in. We'll get sunny skies both Thursday and Friday. On Thursday, winds will be out of the north, and that'll keep the temperature below freezing, a daytime high of 29. But on Friday, the winds become more southerly, and our daytime high will warm up to 40 degrees. So kind of a big swing when it comes to our temperatures between Thursday and Friday. And then this weekend, we talked about it yesterday, that we might be able to add in a slight chance for some wet weather. Forecast models are split at this point. So there is going to be a system coming in from the Pacific Northwest going into this weekend. But whether or not it actually moves through Utah, that's the question. I do think that we'll at least see increasing cloud coverage, but whether or not we actually see the moisture play out, that's another story entirely. If we do see any moisture, it would likely be between Saturday night into Sunday. So on Sunday, a slight chance of snow. The daytime highs will mainly be ranging in the mid-30s, but by early next week, a little bit more optimistic forecast models, a little bit better of agreement that we could see a more potent system ride between Tuesday and Wednesday. So we'll continue to fine-tune that forecast as we go throughout this weekend, but both days, Saturday and Sunday, should see daytime highs in the mid to upper 30s, Leslie.
Okay, Thomas, thanks so much.
You're welcome.
And with a look in the backcountry and the fun with us from the Utah Avalanche Forecast Center, it's Dave. Good morning, Dave.
Good morning. How are you this morning?
I'm doing great. Thanks.
Good. For today, we're looking at a moderate avalanche danger on upper and middle elevation slopes where human-triggered avalanches are possible in the new and wind-drifted snow. These avalanches will be 1 to 2 feet deep. And then there's a low avalanche danger on lower elevation terrain where there has been less new snow. Human-triggered avalanches are going to be possible on slopes where the new snow has drifted into a harder slab of dense snow or on steep slopes where the sun has warmed the surface. A really great option for today is to let things settle out and stick to lower angle objectives where there is still good powder skiing to be had. Yesterday we had reports of natural soft slab avalanches running on steep slopes during the storm, and then loose dry avalanches running on a density change within that new snow, 1 to 2 feet deep.
Okay, thanks, Dave.
Thank you.
Good morning, I'm Leslie Thatcher. Stay tuned. Coming up on the Local News Hour this morning, we'll be checking in with Deputy Summit County Manager Jana Young. She'll be previewing Wednesday's meeting. Later on, KUER political reporter Sean Higgins with our weekly legislative report. And finally, the director of Summit Land Conservancy, Cheryl Fox, will be looking at the first expenditure of the Summit County open space bond money for the Andrus Ranch. The Summit County Council meeting Wednesday, starting at 2 o'clock in work session at the Richens Building. In the studio with a preview, I have Deputy County Manager Jana Young. Good morning, Jana.
Good morning, Leslie.
So first, thanks of all for your service as interim county manager the last 6 months and taking on these radio reports. We appreciate that. Yeah, let's start with a quick legislative preview that you'll be giving. Anything that you're watching that concerns you?
Yeah, you know, this session has gotten off to a slow start. We're hearing rumblings of bills, but we haven't actually seen them yet. But as you know, every Wednesday I do provide updates to the County Council on some of the issues we are tracking or working on. And so the ones that I will be flagging tomorrow include SB 174 and HB 364. These are housing affordability bills that build upon legislation adopted last year, requiring certain cities and counties to adopt a moderate income housing plan by October 1st, with strategies and benchmarks for encouraging the development of moderate income housing within those communities. We were told that around 70% of the moderate income housing plans submitted were deficient in some way. And so the legislature's considering some approaches to improve that situation, a little bit more punitive than what they had done last year. For example, SB 174 is proposing a penalty of $360 a day to those non-compliant entities. But then HB 364 provides an appeal process. So there's at least a way to argue, entities to argue who want to dispute the determination from the State Workforce Services that their plan is deficient or non-compliant. So we'll continue to watch those bills and see as they move through the process. There's always opportunity for substitutes and amendments. Another bill that we're following is HB 261, fire-related amendments, which I believe I mentioned on last week's show. It has been substituted, altered, since the last time I spoke about it, and has passed out of the House. It's now in the Senate Rules Committee. It addresses prescribed fires and pile burns on private lands, as well as addresses when burning is allowed. And one of the new provisions that could potentially be concerning is the bill does strip away authority from our local fire wardens to permit burning and instead gives that responsibility to the state forester. We haven't had a chance to speak with our fire warden to understand the consequences of this move, but it does fall under the general concern that this bill removes local decision making. We believe those decisions, especially concerning burning, are best made locally, particularly because we are those that have to live with the impacts, the public health impacts of that, if it's not done under the right conditions. And then another bill we're following is SB 76, water amendments. It's a pretty hefty bill that we haven't actually been able to get through completely yet. But essentially, it's taking several actions to save the Great Salt Lake, which, of course, we support. We're just unsure what impact the mandates will have on us locally, and we just have to prepare to respond. For example, the bill requires certain municipal and county planning commissions to consult with the Department of Water Resources in the development of general plans. It requires counties to request feedback from certain water systems. There's also an effort in there to regionalize water systems at the local level. So we'll continue to talk to Mountain Regional Water about that, as well as our planning department will look at it. A quick update on the short-term rental bill. I had mentioned this last week as well. It's HB 291, Representative Musselman's bill. The county clerk, in consultation with our finance director, is actually requesting a couple of small changes to this bill that will help us ensure the right taxes are being received for nightly rentals and that all nightly rentals are obtaining business licenses. So the change specifically would include requiring short-term rentals to report their sales and use tax by exact location rather than zip code, which is how Airbnb and VRBO do it now. And the benefit of doing that is it allows counties and cities to make sure that the collected taxes are going to the correct entity. Sometimes there's confusion between the Snyderville Basin and Park City because of zip codes and such as that. So sometimes Park City gets our taxes and vice versa. The second benefit is also that by requiring sales and use tax number for each unit to be, or for each unit to be unique, we could cross-reference the sales tax number with the business license issued to make sure everyone renting through Airbnb and VRBO actually has a business license. And then, of course, we can receive taxes from those who have a business license but aren't paying. So we've requested those changes, and we'll see if the bill sponsor is amenable to them.
Okay. Let's see. Also a short discussion with regard to the National Association of Counties Public Lands request. What's the request?
Yeah, so at the national level, NACO, the National Association of Counties, is trying to establish what they're calling a National Center for Public Lands Counties. And what that will do, or the purpose of this center, is to help raise attention and education, especially at the federal level, to the important role that public lands play in our nation's prosperity by showing how public lands are interconnected with the county's needs economically and also from a natural infrastructure perspective. And so they're trying to raise about $15 million total for the center. They're asking that each public lands county, and these are counties that receive payment in lieu of taxes. So if you have a large swath of federal land within your borders, but you can't collect taxes on that land, but you're providing services, you do get federal monies for that. So counties who get those allocations received an extra money through the recovery initiatives after COVID at the federal level. So NACO's asking for 1% of those allocations to go to this center. And then what's happening is the Utah Association of Counties is collecting all of those contributions and seeing if we can make as a state what NACO wanted from us. And if so, we'll provide those funds to NACO. Otherwise, the monies will be given back to the entities who have contributed. We actually brought this up with the council back in earlier in January to see if they're interested in providing this. The payment for us would be about $8,507, so not a huge impact. The council just asked that we learn more about what other counties have contributed and to study some of the NACO policy statements around public lands to see if our priorities align. So the recommendation that I'll be providing to the council tomorrow is that they go ahead and contribute this amount of money. I think the Utah Association of Counties needs to know by February 12th if we'll be contributing. And primarily because we can benefit from this center. We are a public lands county, but also it can help improve our relationships within NACO and across the, or within Utah Association of Counties and across the state.
Yeah, so have you found out? I mean, are there counties contributing?
There are. Mm-hmm. We had heard that Salt Lake, Beaver, Wayne, Paiute, Carbon, Rich, and San Juan counties have submitted payments. I've also been told that a number of others have submitted since I last got the report. I asked for UAC to give me an update so I can share that with the council tomorrow, but it does sound like several others have joined as well.
Okay, what about other? Are there some that said absolutely no way? Or
I haven't heard.
Okay. Let's see. We've got about 3:30, a discussion regarding the Dakota Pacific Park City Tech Center Amendment. We're going to have a look at the traffic impact study. Carl Miller, Brandon Brady, I guess, will be presenting it. They're from the Wall Consulting Group.
No, those are actually county staff members. Carl is our transportation planner, and Brandon is the deputy. They have been spearheading this peer review study through the process. Just to give a little bit of background, so as you recall, last week, Dakota Pacific presented to the council and to the public their most recent plan or most current plan proposed development in the Tech Center area in Kimball Junction. This is what we're calling their Plan C. They have conducted a traffic study on that Plan C. And the reason why we do this, or developers do this, or the county asks for this, is we want to understand the traffic impacts of a new development. And within those studies, they provide recommendations for mitigating those impacts, as well as understanding safety concerns of those who may live in that area or frequent that area. So they have done a traffic study on their Plan C. The county, in doing its due diligence as requested by the public, a year ago in December, when we had our public hearing on this development, we have commissioned a peer review of that study to just verify the information. And I think it's, you know, I'm not a traffic engineer. It's certainly a very technical process. But I think what's helpful is to understand the Dakota Pacific traffic study. It's helpful to look at our peer review report. And you'll notice in that, and what I have gathered from staff who are more technical experts, is there are a number of, I guess, missing elements that our peer review had identified. within that traffic study, as well as some recommendations for mitigation strategies. And so first, I think the biggest takeaway for me, compared to the previous development proposals at this site, which also had traffic studies on them, the current development program will generate the least daily traffic, the least peak hour traffic, and have the least impact on existing traffic congestion. So it does support what Dakota Pacific has shared with us, and that they have shrunk their footprint there. I think the traffic study is showing that. Second, in terms of what the missing elements are, is our peer review found that the safety analysis and mitigation evaluation, or it's missing a safety analysis and mitigation evaluation to ensure safe operations for all travelers. There's also model calibration documentation that is needed to verify the traffic modeling results, and then queuing assessment and travel time documentation for additional measures of effectiveness to compare existing and observed operations to the proposed mitigated future operations. And so you'll notice then in the recommendations, they suggest considering or adding those that documentation and those elements. And then there's a number of recommendations, again, around requiring safety-related improvements, basing occupancy in the various buildings in a phased approach to try to mitigate some of the traffic, certainly waiting for other infrastructure to come into place, such as our bus rapid transit project, which will certainly help congestion in this area. There's a suggestion to add a northbound through lane at UDOT, or at the State Route 224 in Kimball Junction, asking UDOT to finish that area plan, recommending partial build, full build strategies and things like that. So again, I think it'll be a fairly technical presentation. I'm hoping through the questions that the council has, that will kind of dumb this down a little bit and allow the public to truly understand, not to say the public's dumb, but to truly understand what these traffic studies are telling us.
Well, the report's nearly 1,800 pages
right.
long, right? And there's a ton of small numbers in it as well. And I guess we are relying now on this Wall Consulting Group to,
yes.
and to also, figure this out for us.
Yeah, and also our staff, our traffic engineers and our planners have also looked at both studies, and they understand it pretty well. And I think they will also help advise the council on what it says.
Yeah, and something I read was that the analysis did not consider a 20-year future scenario, which is a typical UDOT standard planning scenario. So do we ask them to go back and make sure that that 20-year outlook is in there?
Yeah, it'll be interesting what the council decides to do based on this information. Obviously, there are some elements missing, as I stated, and as well as the issue you raised. So it's possible, I suppose, that the council could make that request to the developer that we better understand these things that are missing.
Okay, at 6 o'clock, then a public hearing on the development code amendments regarding setbacks. Are we increasing them or reducing them? Or
I think this is more of a cleanup provision. Currently, streams, lakes, and ponds are not defined in our Snyderville Basin Development Code. And where that's come into a problem or become a problem is there are homes and development that have occurred around these natural ponds, but they were in place before our code even addressed them. And so the challenge is when we need to make changes or applicants come forward wanting to make changes, there's not a lot of remedy in those situations other than asking for a special exception or variance. Now, the interesting thing is the Eastern Summit County Planning Code does have some of these elements. And so a lot of what's being recommended by the staff is mirroring what's in the Eastern Summit County Development Code. And again, just to better address these situations, you know, what's the setback when you are building near a pond or have making changes to your structure when you're already there, that type of thing. They're also looking at, obviously, downstream contamination issues in our stormwater and other things. And so that's the also the importance of having setbacks in that situation, too, around flowing water.
Okay. And if you're still awake after that two-hour traffic presentation, from 7 to 9, an open house will be held. This is being hosted by Dakota Pacific. And I guess people are asking, why so last minute?
I don't know if it's a last-minute situation. You know, there's been a lot of effort to try to have some public engagement around this project. Since the beginning, now that we have seen the plan and it's been presented to the council, it makes sense to allow this opportunity for the public to come. We were pleased that Dakota Pacific offered to do that. I imagine there'll be additional public input situations too, whether they're public hearings or additional open houses. Again, just to allow the community to understand the development and weigh in with their input as we're in this situation where discussions can occur with the developer.
Yeah, but they couldn't wait a week and at least let us digest the traffic report?
Yeah, and I'm not certain why the timing of this.
There is some concern, though, that Dakota Pacific would like a decision with time still left in the legislative session. Do they have something up their sleeves that we don't know about with regard in the event that their project might get turned down?
You know, we're not certain of what the plans are. You know, there's always discussions. We have a strong lobbying team, and they have been working on the Hill to try to pick up what might be considered. And, you know, I think we're anticipating there's probably a legislative action in their back pocket in case things don't go as they want it to, and we'll be prepared to react to that. But we haven't seen anything, and so we're just having to react to what our current code says and the current development plan. And, I think the council's being very deliberate with this process and allowing public input and sort of not slowing it down in a way, but going through the proper channels to make sure we've all had a chance to understand the proposal and react to it. I don't know when a decision will be made, but I do know we will be planning some public hearings on this new plan, so there's still a few more weeks left to this.
Okay. Anything else you want to mention, Jana?
Yeah, I would want to mentioned that Summit County's third kickoff event for our community-wide visioning effort called Our Summit is happening tonight in this county services building in Camas from 6 to 8. There'll be food and free childcare and Spanish language services, really encouraging the community to come out, learn about our visioning process, provide input. We also want folks to know this is not the only time that there will be engagement and outreach around this effort. There'll be multiple events and stakeholder meetings, and we have an ambassador group that's trying to connect us with the community in all areas, and this will occur throughout until September. But also, as part of this, we do have a survey currently out that we're encouraging residents to complete. It can be found on the front page of the county's website at summitcounty.org. And again, the feedback from this effort will help inform updates, revisions, and a possible rewrite of the county's general plan. So we encourage our residents to participate and have a voice in what they want our county to look like in the future.
Okay, Jana, thanks.
Thank you so much.
It's Deputy County Manager Jana Young joining me now on the phone from KUR Radio. I have political reporter Sean Higgins. Good morning, Sean.
Good morning, Leslie.
Let's see, we're almost about halfway through the session, huh?
Yeah, just about half week. I think the halfway point is actually tomorrow, so we're chugging along.
Great. Water Week was declared last week, so what happened?
Yeah, so the legislature wanted to assure everybody that water was still at the top of their list of priorities, so they declared a whole week as Water Week. But what we really noticed is it was not nearly as drastic of changes as we saw last year. Last year was dubbed the Year of Water by the legislature. We saw some really what they called earth-shattering changes to the way water law is actually crafted and enforced in Utah. This year, we heard from some experts in the field. We talked to a couple water attorneys. They said this is more of a fine-tuning year. We don't need to reinvent the wheel every year when it comes to water. So we're seeing a few bills working their way through the legislature right now. Nothing was moved through as quickly last week when it comes to water as we saw earlier in the session with some of those more controversial topics. Kind of a few for the listeners to keep an eye out for. SB 118 would deal with water efficient landscaping incentives. That bill passed in the Senate. It's now on to the full House, and that provides funding for water districts to help pay for water-wise landscaping programs, something I know the listeners at KPCW know well. This whole zero-scape movement, replacing your grass, which is notoriously thirsty with native plants, bark, gravel, things like that. So this will provide, I believe, about $10 million for the state to help dole out to water districts throughout the state to incentivize people to get rid of their lawns. And then another interesting bill that dealt with emergency water shortages that do not relate to a drought like we're in right now. This is HB 150. It sounds a little confusing because we're in a drought right now. We want to say like, hey, we're in an emergency situation right now. But this would actually deal with how the state would respond to an emergency like a water treatment plant going offline. Say there was a mudslide in the mountains and it took out the Park City water treatment plant. This would deal with how the state would react to that and provide funding to help get that back online. Another couple bills, groundwater use amendments. This one's pretty technical, or pretty dense. Passed in the Senate, it's in the House committee right now. It just clarifies that the storage of groundwater is a beneficial use. So storing water for long-term, I guess, called a rainy day fund, excuse the pun on that one, but just having better ways to store water long term. And then a couple bills were not so lucky. We had a bill looking at requiring golf courses to publish how much water they use on their websites. That one was died in committee thanks to the golf course lobby here in Utah. And then a non-binding resolution that would set a target level for the Great Salt Lake of 4,198 feet above sea level. It's about 9 feet above where it is right now. That one failed in committee as well. That actual lake level, the 4,198, is what scientists say is the lowest level that the lake can sustain a healthy ecosystem. So there is a little bit of science behind that. But again, that resolution would have been non-binding. It would just be a statement by the legislature, hey, we want the lake level nine feet higher than it is. That one did not make it out of committee. So Water Week was, it got addressed, but we had saw some slow progress.
Yeah, that's interesting. Just given a resolution, it would be aspirational, no? But they thought it was also a failure in the fact that they may not reach it, or?
Yeah, I think the official reasons given was that it was too narrow and would focus too much attention on the Great Salt. Like, that's at least what the majority in this committee was saying. I think there may have been a little bit of politicking at work. This was a proposal by a freshman Democrat in the Senate, Nate Bluin. He's very young. Maybe a little bit of politicking there to not give an easy win to a newbie and on Capitol Hill. But yes, it would have done nothing. It would have cost no money. It was just a statement by the legislature, and they said no thanks.
All right, what's the latest with regard to House Joint Resolution 2, which would address how injunctions are handled by the courts?
Yeah, so this one is actually, it's called circled in the Senate. So for people who are unfamiliar with how the Utah legislature works, when a bill is being debated and voted on the full House or Senate floor, if there are changes that need to be made, the sponsor of that bill can file a motion to circle, which was essentially take it off the voting calendar so it can be worked on further. The sponsor in the Senate, Senator Jan McKay, decided to circle this in the Senate. So it is currently behind closed doors right now being worked on by the legislators and some stakeholders. The Utah Bar and the State Court Association had some really serious concerns about the effect on current cases. Nobody really knows how many cases in the state this would actually affect. If you talk to the people who support this, it would affect maybe the trigger law, and that is it. For people who are not so into this change, it could affect an unknowable amount of cases that are currently working through the state. I actually spoke with Planned Parenthood of Utah at the end of last week, and they believe that based on their understanding of the current change, that the injunction that is holding up the trigger law in Utah would not be automatically lifted if HJR 2 were to pass. They told me that the state would actually need to file what's called called a motion to reconsider based on the new standards that this resolution would create. This would result in a series of motions and an eventual hearing before the judge that issued the original injunction before the injunction would actually be evaluated. But they did say that this would make the state's case much easier to argue. So this isn't an automatic retroactive takeaway of these injunctions. There is a process that needs to happen here. And I think working out what that process would actually look like, how many cases this affects, is something that the legislators, the bar, and the courts are really trying to iron out.
Yeah. And the joint resolution, I mean, it was targeting the trigger law, right? And then it was like, oh my goodness, there are other injunctions out there. I mean, that was kind of almost an afterthought, huh?
When you hear the original sponsor of this bill, Representative Brady Brammer, talk about it, I believe his exact quote when he was asked about the trigger law being the inspiration behind this, I think he said, "The trigger law triggers this type of discussion." So take that with what you will. So they're arguing that this would put the Utah court injunction process more in line with how the federal government issues injunctions. It would take out basically half of a sentence in Utah code that would just make it a little, the standard for issuing an injunction just a little bit higher. So it's not explicitly targeting the trigger law. It's like Representative Brammer said, it triggered this type of discussion.
Okay. Again, education, a couple of bills making it through the House yesterday. Tell us about those.
Yeah, so a couple of bills. We had the big HB 215 early in the session. That was the teacher raise and the school choice program. We're working on school safety now. The legislative leaders had a big press conference end of last week talking about some of the things that they're going to be targeting. We saw HB 107. That's a bill to remove concealed carry fees for teachers. That passed the House 57-12. So a lot of the Democrats not very happy with that one. They don't think more guns in school is the right approach here. A lot of these are kind of reaction to some of the tragic school shootings we've seen over the last year or so. That bill is on to Senate committee, so we'll see the fate of that in the Senate, whether it gets amended or not. Again, that would just, if you are a educator, I believe working over 20 hours a week in school and you applied to become a concealed carry individual in the state of Utah, those fees associated with that would be waived. And HB 140 would require monthly active shooter drills in schools. That passed unanimously in the House yesterday. That is on to the Senate. Another reaction to these really horrendous school shootings we've seen over the past year. And another one, last week, HB 270 would have banned cell phones in classes. That one actually failed in committee. I think listening to some of the discussion around that, the spirit behind it, there's a lot of people who support the idea of less distractions in the classroom, but we heard a lot of teachers and education professionals really worried about how that would actually be enforced in a classroom. Also, it's private property. Is it right for a public school to take away a student's property without their consent, basically? So that one actually failed in committee. Well, maybe it'll get resurrected next year, but that was news on the education front last week.
And the bill, the HB 140, about those monthly active shooter drills, I understand the importance of being prepared. At the same time, any concern, though, that we're just traumatizing our students even more?
I think this is a really interesting question that a lot of people are considering. I think they're not calling them active shooter drills. They're calling them active threat drills. So whether that has any effect on it, but I think that's an interesting argument, and people have definitely made that argument. One of our reporters here, Martha Harris, is our education reporter. They did a feature on this exact issue. So if you want to head over to KUER.org, look that story up, you can hear more about it. But there's a serious concern over the effectiveness of these, over whether it's just traumatizing children, and the fact that almost all of these tragic shootings are carried out by someone who goes to school there. So they're actually learning the protocols before they carry out these attacks. So there's definitely two sides to this, but it had unanimous support in the House.
Yeah. So when does the education budget get discussed? I mean, what are we going to see? What kind of WP EU funding will be available for school districts?
Yeah, so Governor Cox actually signed the education base budget. So this is the first step in the formal budgeting process. He signed it last week. The Senate and the House kind of passed these base budget amendments early on in the session, just kind of getting general numbers figured out, and then the actual hard numbers are ironed out later in the session. So the education base budget that was signed last week, almost $59 million in operating and capital budgets for the next fiscal year. And that works out to a weighted pupil unit of about $4,100 per student. And again, there is some wiggle room there when this process gets a little bit farther down the road. Appropriations is the next one of the next big steps in the legislature as we head towards the second half.
Okay, there was a bill addressing conversion therapy in committee yesterday, and again, we're talking about therapy for somebody who expresses right as LGBTQ.
Yeah, so this bill, HB 228, it was called Professional Conduct Amendments. This dealt specifically with what is known as talk therapy. So conversion therapy, as it is traditionally known, has been banned in Utah since 2020, actually. And this would have altered what therapists can talk with their patients about when it comes to issues of sexuality, gender identity, and things like that. And some news yesterday, as it was in committee, a deal was reached to keep the ban in place, but clarify what therapists can and cannot talk about. Equality Utah actually signed on to this, so they are in favor of the bill as it currently is written right now. It passed out of committee yesterday and is now on to the full House, so we'll see if it gets amended further.
Okay. I haven't been to Salt Lake in a while. What's it like down there? Gucky?
Over the weekend and last week was pretty gross, but we got some blue skies right now.
Okay, so talk a little bit about the clean air bills.
Yeah, so we had a really pretty significant bill get introduced by Representative Andrew Stoddard of Sandy end of last week, HB 220. This is really kind of a moonshot bill that would address everything from emissions from cars to building requirements to banning things like wood-burning stoves. He told me yesterday that he really wanted to shoot his shot with this, put it out there and say, like, hey, this is my dream. Here's what we get passed in my ideal world. He's very well aware of the political realities for Democrats here in Utah. He needs support of many, many Republicans to get any of this passed. He said he's talking with House leadership right now on things they do and don't like. Republicans have run clean air bills in the past. There are elements of those bills similar to those bills in his bill. So he said he's cautiously optimistic that he'll get something by the end of the session, but we will see. That is in the House Rules Committee right now, so no formal committee hearing on that one yet. And then there is a Senate joint resolution to encourage people to not idle their cars. I know many municipalities in Utah, I believe Park City as well, has a no idling ordinance in place. This would just encourage people to turn their car off as they wait in line for their drive-through food or they're sitting outside picking up their kids from school.
Finally, just wanted to ask you quickly about any land use bills that you are aware of out there. I know that that's something that always makes the Summit County and Park City a little nervous.
Yeah, so not much, but interesting. HB 233 filed by Summit County Representative or Kara Berkland actually would repeal provisions requiring certain counties to implement plans for creating these HTRZs, these housing and transit reinvestment zones, as a strategy to increase moderate income housing. I know very little about this bill. This is another bill that is brand new. It's in the House Rules Committee right now. We'll learn more about it if it gets a committee hearing, but this would deal with HTRZ zones that we've been seeing pop up. I know Dakota Pacific, as you were just talking about, was pitched at one point as an HTRZ, and this was something that the Summit County Council was a little upset about last year, the legislature essentially forcing these HTRZs down their throats a little bit. So we'll see what comes of this one.
Okay. Hey, Sean, thanks for your time.
Thank you, Leslie.
Sean Higgins, again, political reporter with KUER Radio. Joining me now in the studio with an update from Summit Land Conservancy, I have Executive Director Cheryl Fox. Good morning.
Good morning.
First, let's talk a little about the allocation of the Summit County General Obligation Bond for the project that you actually brought forth to the county council, and that's the Andrus Family Farm.
That's right. We're really honored to be the first, recipient of the county's general obligation bond, the GO bond, or some people are calling it the GO bond, which was passed last year, 2021. I guess that's 2 years ago now, to fund open space conservation across the county. So it was the first countywide open space bond. So the county spent a lot of time figuring out how to make sure that there was a good public process for reviewing projects that would come forward. Then they started a notice of intent process late in 2022. And of course, the Summit Land Conservancy, you know, knowing that the GO bond was out there, had been working with a number of landowners, and as we always do with some projects. And so as we watched the process go through, you know, the county formed three different regional districts of local representatives who would sit down and say, okay, in South Summit, we really want to protect these things. And in North Summit, we want to protect those things. And in Western Summit County, Park City, maybe we have a little bit of a different focus. So that was super helpful for the Summit Land Conservancy, because then we can say, okay, now I have a landowner near Camas, Marion, actually. And this landowner's property, it is to the west of SR 32. So if you're driving between Oakley and Camas, it's the downhill side away from the Uintas. So it's right out there in the middle of the wet meadows. And this was one of the things that the South Summit Group felt was one of their most important places to preserve. They want to protect the Camas Meadows. They want to protect the aquifer that's under the Camas Meadows. They want to protect active agriculture. And of course, the viewshed as you're, you know, driving along 32. So this project hit all of those criteria that the South Summit Group had had outlined. So when the notice of intent process finally opened, the Summit Land Conservancy, by that point, we had been working with this family for a long time. Actually, all of our landowners have to have a lot of patience. The landowner in this case walked into our office, I think 2011 or 2012, and said, I want to save my 100 acres in Marion. And in those days, we didn't have enough funding sources to put together to do that project. And I just have to say, Irene has been so patient. I mean, literally waiting 10 years, 11 years. So when the GO bond passed, we thought, okay, now there's a funding source here that we can actually do this in conjunction with other funding. So the Summit Land Conservancy received a $1.7 million federal award to do this project. And then the next pieces were to go to the county and ask for money, which we did. And, you know, they do this in closed session first. And then, you know, when they finally say, okay, yes, we're going to allocate money, that's an open session event. So we were really excited, and again, honored to be trusted with the first expenditure of this open space bond money.
Yeah, and it's really peanuts. I mean, when you think about, right, $50 million. We're talking about, and we're taking $250,000 from it.
Well, I know that the county really wants to leverage this money, which is why, and you know, of course, the Summit Land Conservancy, we want to see this money go as far as possible also. So we share that interest. So that's why, you know, we try to put together partnerships with as many different funding sources as we can.
Yeah. So did you have to have that 200 or 500,000, because you're also getting another 250 from the Eastern Summit County Agricultural Preservation Committee. Mm-hmm. Did you have to have that $500,000 then to get the 1.7 from the Natural Resources Conservation Service?
You know, in order to make the whole transaction work, yes, no one funding source wants to be, you know, the single funding source. Also, in this and most cases, the landowners are making a substantial donation as well. So again, we put together all of these funding partners, and we have some private foundations coming to the table. And all of this, I always say it, all of this is made possible because of individual contributions to the Summit Land Conservancy.
Yeah. So do you have any more that you're hoping to bring?
Yes, we do. Yeah. The way the county's process is working now, we bring those in closed session with a notice of intent. And we are in the process of doing that.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Let's see. No more summer camps. How come?
Well, the Summit Land Conservancy has recognized that, well, first of all, the kids love them. The parents love them. We love them. We had so much fun with the kids and getting them. You know, it was one of the main tenants was just some free time to play and make up your own games outside. But organizing ourselves to have summer camps was a big staffing exercise, actually, because, of course, you know, we want to make sure that kids don't get eaten by something out there. So we decided that for a couple reasons. One, we want to do some things in Wasatch County and Morgan County because we're doing more conservation work up there. And the summer camps really tied us down, you know, for 6 weeks full-time with a fairly substantial staff. And we wanted to reach out to a broader community, and we also wanted to allocate a little more resources to land conservation because we have so many opportunities right now, and we really need to, we need to do more, and we need to do it faster.
All right, but you still will be offering kind of your hops, hikes, and things like that.
Absolutely, and those are free activities, so there will still be hops, hikes this coming summer. There will be nature bathing this coming summer, and a month from today, March 7th, there will be a moonshine adventure where, you know, we ski up at the resort. And then go to Offset Beer and drink beer and save land because our friends there make a beer for us, and it's real fun. So those are activities, you know, people do need to sign up for those because there's limited space, but they're free.
Okay.
Yeah.
Let's see, and you are hiring.
We are looking for a conservation leadership intern. Yes, this is a paid internship. We're really excited about this. Because we're really looking for somebody to get involved with our organization, and it's both learning, because we're going to have this person do stewardship visits in the summer. They will go out with our conservation team and do mapping exercises. They will also help with our outreach considerably, but our outreach, like I said, is going farther afield. We are hoping to find somebody whose native language is not English to participate in this. And the best thing about it is, so this person also needs to be 18 years or older, because we are going to send this person to the National Land Trust Conservation, which is happening, Conservation Conference, which is happening in Portland, Oregon. And I just think that it would be great for this person to be able to see that land conservation happens all across the nation. You know, there are 1,000 land trusts like the Summit Land Conservancy doing work like we're doing. And I find that really inspiring. And so we were given a really lovely gift from Frank and Alice Puglio, actually, that allows us to send this person to this conference. So it's really a great opportunity, I think, for both the somebody who is interested in looking at conservation broadly, perhaps as a future career, and also to help the Summit Land Conservancy as we expand, too.
Yeah, so it's a paid internship.
Absolutely.
And it's, what, just through the summer then?
It's mostly in the summer. It'll start in May. The conference, the Land Trust Alliance Conference, is in early September. We're assuming that this person probably has college or other activities like that. So it's most intense in the summer, yes.
Okay. Anything else you want to mention?
We're doing an awful lot of conservation, and it's a beautiful, we're so grateful to have all of this snow, and I hope people look at this as a nature giving us a little bit of a breathing room to hopefully solve our problems with the Great Salt Lake.
Okay, Cheryl, thanks for your time.
Thank you.
Cheryl Fox is the Executive Director of Summit Land Conservancy.